Welcome to The Sound of Economics, Bruegel's podcast series on economic issues. In December of 2022, the European Central Bank announced the start of the unwinding of the portfolio of assets it had purchased since 2015. This policy is often referred to as quantitative tightening. The aim is to start by reducing its holdings by 15 billion euro every month between March and June of 2023. Quantitative tightening has never been tried in the euro area, and what little evidence there is can only be drawn from the 2017-2019 experience in the US. Why did the ECB decide to go down the route of quantitative tightening? Why isn't increasing interest rates sufficient to reduce inflation? And might there be risks in general, or in particular now with problematic banks across both sides of the Atlantic introducing instability in the system? I am Maria Demergis. I am a senior fellow at Bruegel, and I'm delighted to have with me to discuss these issues and more, Gregory Claes. Hi, Gregory.
Hello.
Who is a colleague here at Bruegel, and Megan Green. Hi, Megan.
Hi there.
Who is the global chief economist at the Kroll Institute in the US. Thank you both for joining me today, discussing what's next in monetary policy. What I want us to discuss is a little bit about quantitative tightening. Gregory, you have written a wonderful paper, actually, which is published in our website at Bruegel, on what it is and what it really entails, the risks and the benefits of doing that. But I'd like us also to put the context of quantitative tightening in the broader monetary policy framework, particularly now where we are seeing also financial stability risks. But let me start with you first, Gregory. Tell us a little bit about quantitative tightening, what it is, and what we can expect in the next few months.
Yeah, quantitative tightening, as you said in your nice introduction, actually is the unwinding of the asset purchased during quantitative easing. That's the way we define it. Actually, there are different definitions. Some people consider that quantitative tightening is a reduction in the balance sheet of the central bank. But in my view, we should be more precise than that, because the reduction of a balance sheet of a central bank can happen in different ways. Actually, at the moment, in the euro system, the balance sheet has been reduced for already a year. Not only because of the unwinding of QE assets that have been taking place in the last months, but because there have been some lending through what we call TLTRO, so lending to commercial banks that were done since 2014. And basically, banks have been reimbursing this lending to the ECB, and actually they have been reimbursing massively in the last few months. And so the balance sheet has been reduced already through this reimbursement of loans from the ECB to the commercial bank. But let's differentiate that from QT. QT is really the unwinding of previous asset purchase. So basically, by either letting those assets mature or by selling them, this is not what the ECB is doing, but there are different ways of doing QT. But let's say it's the unwinding, the general unwinding of assets bought during QE.
Can you give us a sense of the numbers here? Because so the balance sheet of the ECB at its peak was about 8.5 trillion. Am I right?
Yeah, almost 9 trillion. Actually, it's very similar. Both the US Fed balance sheet and the ECB balance sheet, they both peaked at around 9 trillion. Actually, the ECB balance sheet, the euro system balance sheet, because we talk about like the consolidated balance sheet of the ECB and the national central banks, has already go down by 1 trillion because of the reimbursement of TLTROs. So even though we started QT later than the Fed, actually our balance sheet already went down much faster thanks because of the reimbursement of those loans.
But as you say, this is something that is a liquidity issue that is being resolved. The banks are paying back the liquidity they're provided. But QT is not about that, right?
In my view, it shouldn't be about that. In my view, it's really the reversal of QE.
So this is now the central bank that is releasing the assets back into the markets. And, you know, basically quantitative tightening is about doing that, you know, actively, not even passively, right?
No, it can be both, actually. It can be active by sales. Actually, for instance, the Bank of England is doing it actively. It's selling bonds that it has bought during QE. while the ECB and the Fed are doing that in a kind of passive way. They are letting assets mature. And actually, they are not even letting all assets mature. They are only letting mature part of the assets. So they cap every month the quantity of assets that they let mature. They still reinvest part of it so that basically it falls more gradually than if you would let it mature entirely, fully by itself.
Megan, if I can come to you, and I would also like to hear from you the US perspective here, because I mean you're in a very nice position to basically check both positions. When central banks did quantitative easing, they were trying to provide lots of cash in the economy to try and stimulate the economy. We were at the lower bound of interest rates. There wasn't anything else you could do on the interest rates. And therefore, the one way of helping the economy from the monetary policy side was to just provide all these assets, liquidity actually, not in the bank to the banks, but actually, you know, cash to the economy. Now, quantitative tightening by symmetry would mean you're taking this, you're taking all this liquidity back, right? Is it as symmetric as it sounds?
Yeah. So Janet Yellen, when she was chair at the Fed, famously said that quantitative tightening would be like watching paint dry. And that was certainly the Fed's hope and every other central bank's hope. And in fact, it continues to be the Fed's hope that it just sort of happens in the background automatically up to a certain cap. And no one really pays attention to it. And that has kind of been the case that no one's really paid attention to it. If you think of all the ink spilled on interest rates over the past couple of months, relative to the size of central bank balance sheets, you know, everyone's razor focused on interest rates, not at all focused on the balance sheet. But actually, I don't think that they happen symmetrically. So when you announce QE, there's a huge signaling effect. And some academic papers, and I should highlight that we have a very poor understanding of exactly how QE does feed through into the markets and into the real economy. But according to some academics, there's this huge signaling effect where all of the impact of QE sort of happens up front as markets price accordingly. When you announce QT and you announce that it's going to be really gradual and like watching paint dry, there isn't the same signaling effect. It doesn't happen. You know, when you have QE, it's usually in a crisis. There's kind of a shock and awe announcement. When you announce QT, you're hoping for the opposite. So that signaling effect doesn't really work in reverse. So that's one reason there's an asymmetric effect. There's also an asymmetric effect in that when you do QE, it turns out that you actually change bank behavior. So when the central bank expands its balance sheet, and we've seen this in the US, and to be fair, this is based on academic work by Ravi Rajan, the former central bank governor in India, and some of his colleagues, and it's based on one sample size. So keep that in mind. And the US banking system and markets work very differently from the Eurozone's and the UK's. But in the US, at least, when the Fed expanded its balance sheet, then commercial banks sort of steered reserves into demand deposits. That's since become a problem because anyone can pull their demand deposits whenever they want. But the interest rate that banks have to pay on demand deposits is really low. So that's good for banks who are trying to make money. Time deposits require a higher interest rate. So that means that deposits can be flighty, and that more recently has become a problem. But then also banks end up, rather than just you know, parking those reserves at the Fed and making a very low interest rate, again, they want to make money, so they've been extending credit lines. And those credit lines earn more interest or a greater yield, at least. That's what happens when the Fed expands its balance sheet. Now, when the Fed decides to shrink its balance sheet, banks don't decide, okay, then we're willing to stop making so much money. We're going to sever all of these credit lines with our clients. So banks effectively don't change their behavior just because the central bank decides to shrink its balance sheet. And so that makes it much tougher for the central bank to actually pull off QT because the liquidity needs of banks constantly rises effectively. There's this endless ratchet effect. And so as the central bank tries to withdraw liquidity, banks still need more liquidity. And so you end up with these kind of pockets of dislocation. I think the repo rate spike in the US in September of 2019 was one example of this. What we saw in the UK with the meltdown in the LDI sector is another example. Potentially what we've been seeing in recent bank financial instability is another example. So arguably no one's talking about QT, but maybe we should all be talking about it.
Can I ask you, Gregory, so what's the intention here? I mean, why is there a need to reduce the balance sheet? And if there is an asymmetry in the way that this works and feeds into the economy, it probably won't achieve it, because as Megan is saying, banks are not going to adjust in opposite direction as they did when QE was being, if I understood correctly, banks won't do that. So why is there a need for the central bank to do QT?
To be honest, I looked into all the different arguments of why we need to do QT in the paper in very much detail. So I encourage you to read the paper. But basically, my main conclusion after reviewing all those arguments is that even though, yeah, QT is justified today, but there are good and bad reasons to do QT. And I think, for instance, the economic case for doing QT today is probably relatively weak, to be honest. QT, as Megan said, will have probably not much effect in terms of its impact on yield and more generally on the economy, because QE had a lot of effect because it was done in bad times. There was a signaling effect that Megan mentioned, etc. While normally QT happen in a situation where everything is okay, so you shouldn't have this big effect that QE had. So in that sense, QT is not QE in reverse, and I agree with Megan.
Okay,
that. So,
now that's an important point. Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I think in particular for the Eurozone, the most compelling argument to do QT are actually political and legal, not economic. They're political because when QE was done in Europe, there were a lot of people saying that QE was done because we wanted to basically monetize the debt of country like Italy, etc. If you do QT, basically you prove those people wrong. You prove that the ECB did not intend to permanently monetize the debt of Eurozone country. You see what I mean?
This is very interesting, because just on this point, could it be that by actually doing QT, it is now and therefore effectively selling Italian debt, right? It actually introduces a problem?
It's not selling, it's letting mature and letting mature it very gradually. I'll come back to that later, but let me finish actually about this. So I think, yeah, politically, it's important to do QT in Europe because it shows that basically there is no fiscal dominance and that the ECB was not monetizing the debt. And I think from a legal perspective, if you remember, the Court of Justice of the European Union put some constraint on QE because there were some cases that were brought to the Court of Justice, etc., on QE, on the OMT, and it put like some constraint. And two of those constraints was that QE needed to be temporary and proportional. And I think doing QT today shows that QE was temporary because we are doing QT. So basically the ECB will not hold those bonds forever. And also it's proportional now with inflation well above the inflation target of the ECB, well above 2%. It would not be proportional to continue holding those bonds forever if inflation is high. So I think basically the most important reason to do QT is that actually it makes QE more conventional in the Eurozone. It proves the people who were against QE that they were wrong, and it makes QE easier to use in the future, both from a legal and political perspective, but also from a practical perspective, because now the euro system holds a lot of assets, and basically in Europe also there are limits to the quantity of assets that the euro system can hold, and basically you need sometimes to go down if you want to go up later. So I think it's good from both a political, legal, and in practice also perspective to do QT.
Yeah, can I just jump in and say that I totally agree. There's no real economic or financial reason that central banks have to do QT. But there are political reasons, and that extends beyond the ECB. It also extends to the Fed, the Bank of England. Central banks can technically take losses on these assets and run in the red. They're not like normal banks, so that's totally fine. But there is a risk of central banks holding so many government bonds and being forced to kind of buy up more to finance whatever pet project a government might have. And so that's a real concern for central banks as well, to avoid kind of monetary financing, even beyond the Eurozone, and to maintain their independence, which I think is of huge concern for central banks.
If I was to just summarize this point, because it is a very important point, why QE was a monetary policy decision? What you're saying, QT is not a monetary policy decision, right?
It shows that QE was a monetary policy decision and not fiscal dominance.
Okay, but okay, I'll settle with that. But then let's come, I think, to the risks, right? Because there are maybe QE had, of course, there were good reasons why we did QE. But it also brought some risks, and there are of particular nature in the euro area, but also, as we hear from Megan right now, no, there are similar reasons in the US, even if fragmentation isn't really the order of the day. But now with QT, it's just the risks of QE that are precipitating us doing QT, right, Gregory?
Yeah. No, but and actually now I can answer to the question that you asked me before, is that I agree that I agree with Megan that the question about independence is true everywhere, but it's much more important in the Eurozone because we have like 19 and now actually 20 countries part of the Eurozone. And so ECB has been buying 19 different bonds, and it's much more complicated because there is always this fear of monetary financing that is clearly forbidden in the European treaty. So the question is true everywhere, but it's more acute in Europe as always.
I would actually argue the opposite, just because of the structure of the ECB, that the ECB's independence is much more secure than any other central banks, because it's going to be impossible to get that many countries to reopen treaties and change the ECB's mandate. So in my view, the ECB is the most independent central bank and has the, you know, has to worry the least about having that taken away, for example, in the US, just by a stroke of pen by Congress. So I guess you could argue it both ways.
Oh, yeah, that's an interesting point of view.
Yeah, it is a very, very nice point of view, because, you know, most of us tend to think like Gregory, actually. And the reason for that is because there's so many political possibilities of things going wrong, whereas in a country that has got one sovereign, one central bank, is just the one. But your point is very well taken, all the more by the influence, maybe. But yeah, as you say, it can be argued both ways. But let's go back to QT then and just see, okay, so we're doing it because we have to, reverse some of the risks that we took with QE. But in doing that, what kind of risks are we introducing into the system? Megan, may I start with you?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think one risk is that you exit this environment of ample reserves inadvertently. And I think that's what we saw when the Fed was trying to do QT in 2017 to 2019. When you talked to, you know, people at the markets desk at the New York Fed about why the repo rate spiked, they sort of said, well, you know, we knew we were getting into the belly of the curve and we knew we would hit a wall at some point. We knew we would know when we had removed too many reserves from the system, but we would only know it when we got there. And so we found it. We hit the wall. That's why the repo rate spiked. And so even now, when you talk to the Fed or other central banks and say, well, aren't you worried about withdrawing too much liquidity from the system? They sort of say, well, we know from the repo rate spike in the US that we have to continue to have ample reserves. And when you ask them, well, you know, how much is that? It's more of an art than a science to figure out how much it is. So there is a risk that we withdraw too many reserves. I will say that the Fed and the Bank of England have actually put in place some architecture to try to deal with that as sort of a release valve in standing repo facilities. For the Fed, though, the only eligible counterparties are banks. And so I just don't think it's big enough in terms of counterparty eligibility to actually help in a major crisis if you did have a big spike in one of the short-term rates. The Bank of England has done it differently. They've also set up a standing repo facility for non-banks with high-quality collateral requirements. I think that was probably a really good move and is something that the Fed and the ECB should probably look at. So there is this kind of release gap. But then also, as I said, when, you know, central banks engage in QE, they fundamentally increase the liquidity needs of banks. And so when they go ahead and shrink their balance sheet, the liquidity needs of banks don't shrink. So we end up hitting these sort of pockets of illiquidity, as we've seen a few times now. And I think we will continue to. The fix for that, as we saw with the Bank of England last fall, is to do more QE, to step in and paper over that market dislocation. And that was effective in the Bank of England's case this one time. But there's a real risk in it. First of all, if you do more QE, then you're just increasing the liquidity needs of banks even more. So you're exacerbating the fundamental problem. But then secondly, we have an inflation problem in most of the developed world. And so central banks are trying to hike rates and lean against inflation. And at the same time, they're also going to be providing QE effectively. And central banks have kind of dumped a lot of different kinds of operations into the QE bucket, which are very different, right? They need to restore market functioning, that's QE. They need to set up lending facilities, that's QE. They're all very different, but we call it all QE. And so markets might look at that and think, well, if you keep doing QE, that's fundamentally going to be inflationary. And that will undermine what central banks are trying to do on the inflation front.
But what I like actually about the ECB is that it's not calling anything QE, actually. Nothing is called QE. And I think the names that the ECB gives to all its asset purchase program explain why they are there. So basically, there is the normal asset purchase program with the public sector purchase program, which was created in 2014-15 to deal with really monetary policy issue, to deal with deflation risk. And then there is the type of other program like the PEP program that was there to deal with both some deflation risk, but also some fragmentation risk. And then we also have this unused kind of QE program, asset purchase programs that were never used, which are OMT and TPI, which are there only to deal with market stress problem on the sovereign bond markets. So to be honest, I think the ECB toolbox in terms of which you could call all of them could be called QE, but they are very well differentiated. And we have a nice panoply of tools which correspond to different type of problems. To be honest, I really like the toolbox that the ECB built little by little since 2012 to this year.
Yeah, no, you make a good point that the ECB has discerned. I'm not sure investors are discerning. I cover the ECB and I can't even remember all the acronyms and what they stand for. So I'm not sure that those distinctions are appreciated in the marketplace. You know, I think a lot of investors just call it all QE.
You might be right.
Yeah, and it's not just about the name. I mean, it is an operation that is actually fundamentally about providing liquidity or providing a sort of a stimulus. It remains a policy for stimulus, even if you intend it for something else, right? And this is what brings us actually to this, if you like, awkward position where what you described, Megan, for the Bank of England's incidents last year, where you have, you know, an increase in the interest rates to deal with one problem, which is stimulating, but then also you have QE, which is also stimulating, which is contractionary on the interest rates. So you're doing with an interest rate contractionary operation, and with QE, you're doing an expansionary operation. It's as though you're stepping on the accelerator and the brake at the same time, right?
But to be honest, to come back to what the BOE did last autumn in October, they did it very well because they were raising rates. They were announcing that they would start QE. Actually, they were going to start QE at the end of September. Of course, there was a mini budget at that time that threw everything away. But what they did is that they did asset purchase, but very temporary. And they revert them as soon as the financial instability episode and the mess in the sovereign bond market ended. So they did very quick asset purchase. So very quick QE, which did not really go in the opposite direction of the asset of the interest rate hikes. So it was, and then they started doing QT. So in the end, I think they came out from this episode in a good shape.
So I would agree. I think the Bank of England pulled it off really well. But I think the only way to avoid QE becoming Hotel California is to, when you announce QE, do what the Bank of England did in this very, very specific incident and say, we're going to do QE, but it's not going to last very long and it won't be that big. And just so you know, it's only for these particular participants, really. And that worked in this particular instance, but you can imagine that's not going to work very well in a crisis, for example. Imagine if in March 2020, the Fed had said, we're going to do QE, but it's not going to last. Don't get used to it. And it won't be that huge. And, you know, you can't do that generally. when you have a crisis. And so for the Bank of England, it was, you know, one sector in particular off the back of this not so mini budget. But I can imagine a scenario going forward when you have a huge liquidity crisis and the central bank can't be so limited in the announcement, and then the signaling effect doesn't work at all. So I think that that's a risk as well. I also think a risk might be that we could end up with these dislocations happening not in the banking sector, but elsewhere, which we haven't faced really, in which case it's much harder for the central bank to step in and provide liquidity specifically. So one example that, you know, I think is a risk in the U.S. Is corporate debt, right? A third of corporate debt in the U.S. is BBB rated. So if you got a bunch of downgrades, then that debt would become junk debt. You would get a bunch of forced selling by bond funds potentially. And then is the Fed going to step in and say, we'll buy all that up? You know, as it turns out, central banks have standards in terms of what they're willing to buy. And so it worked with the Bank of England because they could buy up government bonds. They're willing to buy that. But you could imagine asset classes being the source of instability that central banks aren't willing to buy, like junk debt. And then I think we'll be in a real conundrum.
That is a separate conversation by itself. I mean, but I just want one more issue on this, because then I'd like to also bring it a little bit closer to what is going on today in the financial markets. And Gregory, if I may have a comment from you on this issue, that actually in the Eurozone, we also have the problem that as interest rates goes up, you might actually have a transmission mechanism, the quality of lending, which is very different between countries, the famous financial fragmentation issue. How does that complicate the story?
No, it's true that this is the most often discussed risk in the Eurozone, contrary to what happened in the US or in the UK. I think, yeah, most of the observers, journalists, but even actually members of the Governing Council, when you read the accounts of the ECB Governing Council meeting, you see that they discuss that they are afraid of the impact of QT on sovereign bond markets and how it could be differentiated in different countries. So I think, yes, the reemergence of this fragmentation risk of having like unwarranted increase in spread is really much in everyone's mind in Europe. However, to be honest, I think this risk for the moment, this risk exists and it shouldn't be treated lightly, for sure. But I think for the moment, it's under control in the Eurozone. And actually, it's thanks to the announcements that the ECB made last summer when they created, you know, this transmission protection instrument. Actually, this transmission protection instrument worked really well, because when markets started expecting QT to happen, you see that spread started to increase. Then the ECB announced this TPI in July, and then spread went down, and they went down to fairly moderate level. Like I say that in the paper, like the level is actually equal to the long-term average of spreads. And to be honest, I also checked just before this podcast. Now the spreads have not moved since QT started. So QT. The implementation of QT did not increase spread. It actually went down even during this last month. So it started, of course, it increased when markets started expecting QT, but now it seems that spread have stabilized. And as long as the ECB does QT for a level that is expected by market, I don't expect actually spreads to go up by much, or not at all, actually.
Okay, this is great. So that's a great cue to bring us to sort of, you know, not the last few months, Gregor, but the last few weeks. And let's just see what happens there. Just two banks on either side of the Atlantic, for their own reasons, were get into trouble. They were dealt very differently from the regulators. Huge discussions as to whether the regulators' action was correct or not, and we can talk about that too. But I mean, okay, we haven't seen any real turbulence. But what can we expect, or should we expect, a change of course for monetary policy, both on the QT side as well as on the interest rates, Megan?
So, in my view, Silicon Valley Bank in the U.S. and Credit Suisse in Europe were pretty idiosyncratic. And we're more a case of really poor management and definitely poor risk management than they were of any hints of something truly systemic. So I wouldn't say that this definitely isn't systemic and we can all move along now for sure. I think it's too early to know that. And particularly as major central banks are undergoing QT, we're withdrawing liquidity from the system. So this might be the beginning of something bigger. But, you know, I would say in terms of how central banks should react to this, we do know that credit standards might tighten off the back of this. We've already seen some indication of that in surveys, in which case there will be fewer loans extended, and that will be a drag on growth relative to before the financial stability. Also, there could be a hit to confidence, though right now that seems like it may be temporary. It depends on whether we see more banks wobble off the back of this. And so generally, if that's a bit of a drag on growth, then the peak rate should be a bit lower, I think, in this hiking cycle. I still think that the Fed and the ECB will need to continue to hike rates because they both continue to have an inflation problem. What no one's talking about, again, is the balance sheet. And I actually think the balance sheet is more relevant here. Central banks like to say that they have tools for monetary stability, and they have other very distinct tools for financial stability, and they can delineate between them. And so that's what I'm arguing for, that they should use, you know, rate moves to address inflation, and they should use kind of macroprudential measures and regulation to address financial stability. But I think they should also maybe use the balance sheet to address financial stability. So to my mind, the Fed and the ECB should continue to hike to lean against inflation. They might not get quite as high as they would have gotten without it because growth will be lower now, and that should be on the margin, slightly disinflationary. But actually, it's the balance sheet that they should think more about because they're withdrawing liquidity from the system. So if they want to be able to support the banking sector, they should maybe slow down QE. I don't think we're there yet. They're not really discussing slowing down QE, but I would think that would be the next
QT, you mean?
To use.
Slowing down QT.
That's right. Sorry, slowing down QT.
Slow down QT, yeah, right. Okay. Gregory, do you share that view?
I tend to agree. To be honest, at the current juncture, I don't see a big trade-off between monetary price stability and financial stability. I think either the problem is idiosyncratic and then the marginal effect on financing condition is small and therefore it would change, yes, the terminal rate maybe by 25 basis points or 50 basis points or whatever, but central bank could continue to increase interest rate. And but in that case, there is no real trade-off. It's just that the calibration would be a bit different, or the problem is systemic. And in that case, we know that when you have like financial instability episode, then it becomes very quickly deflationary. And in that case, there would be no trade-off either. Then you would need to cut rates as they did in 2008. So I don't see the problem. Like a lot of people are accusing central banks to not see that trade-off, but I don't think there is a trade-off. Whether it's systemic or it's not, and they need to see which one. I agree with Megan. We don't know yet. I would tend to think that it looks idiosyncratic for the moment, but we will see.
Yeah, I mean, the trouble with that is that nobody knows what is systemic and what isn't. I am prepared to actually personally agree with you that this is very specific to the banks. However, there is one extra complication here, and the complication here is the reaction to what happened. So if you like, the regulatory reaction to this, where actually, you might argue that on both occasions, the regulators overreacted because they really wanted to sit on it. They wanted to go away, so they overreacted. And they went actually beyond what I would call a reasonable interpretation of what they could do. I mean, the deposit guarantee in the US kind of, you know, now creates expectations that go beyond the US. And in the case of Credit Suisse, you had actually somewhat of a reversal of hierarchy in how you deal with a dilution of value when it comes to stress situations through legal means. I mean, I'm not saying that the regulators went beyond their means, but they're actually overreacted in a way that is now creating expectations. And the question is, are you now pushing the threshold of an overreaction elsewhere that might, you know, generate that process that you just described, Gregory, where, you know, then it becomes systemic? Don't you agree?
I would disagree, actually. I mean, I think that guaranteeing deposits at these two failed banks in the U.S., SVB and Signature Bank, was absolutely necessary. And what the, you know, Fed and the Treasury Department and the FDIC have done is sort of implicitly guaranteed all deposits everywhere, but they've gone out of their way not to explicitly agree that. And there is a debate on whether that should be done. You know, I think it's tough to guarantee all the assets for a bank without expecting them to take a lot of risks on the liability side. So, you know, I think that there would be challenges and huge moral hazard that would be injected if authorities were to do that. But, you know, we were looking at a bank run that was extending beyond these idiosyncratic banks. And so I think they absolutely had to guarantee all the deposits. And same with Credit Suisse, you know, on the one hand, authorities went out of their way to sort of arrange this shotgun wedding. In some ways, it's sort of shocking the shotgun wedding hadn't happened three times already. So, you know, I would argue maybe it was appropriate. So I'm not sure that there's a problem in the immediate response. One thing I will say about regulation, though, is that we saw after the global financial crisis that banks were so keen to show how responsible that they were, that they anticipated regulation and started implementing it immediately. And one thing we know in the US, at least, about regulation going forward is that these smaller banks are going to face more of it. So we could see these smaller banks implement anticipated regulation right now, and that too would drag on growth. But even more perniciously, it would probably push a lot of activity out of these smaller banks into shadow banking, where we have very little visibility on what's going on under the hood, who's exposed to what. And so I find that really worrisome as a side of regulation. I'm not saying we shouldn't do it. You know, I think there is an argument for why greater regulation, if Dodd-Frank had been uniformly applied across the banking system in the U.S. as it is in most other countries, we might have avoided some of this. So, you know, I think it's appropriate to have more regulation for smaller banks. But I do think that the nature of investors is that they're going to move out of those smaller banks then and probably move into shadow banking.
Gregory?
No, actually, it's something that is not discussed often about Silicon Valley Bank, is why didn't the Fed use its lending tools to solve the problem? Because it seems, but I don't know a lot about the asset side of Silicon Valley Bank, but from what I understood, a lot of it was like quite safe assets. It was like treasury bonds, long-term mortgage, but safe ones, etc. So it seems that the asset side, it was illiquid, but it was pretty much solvent. Why didn't the Fed use its liquidity tool, actually, as it decided before, as it decided after for all the other banks, basically by creating new liquidity tools and providing liquidity very loosely with at par collateral? Why didn't they offer that to the Silicon Valley Bank? It could have solved the problem, and the Fed would not have had to, and the U.S. administration would not have had to use the FDIC, sorry, would not have used its extension of the deposit insurance.
Yeah, so you're right. If we had all the tools that we have today, then Silicon Valley Bank wouldn't have failed because they wouldn't have had to sell treasuries and other long-term bonds at a huge loss. They could just park them at the Fed at par and get loans in exchange. I think part of the answer is that Silicon Valley Bank is so idiosyncratic given its client base and also its exposure to interest rates. So I think the general prevailing thought was, well, it's pretty unique and so this shouldn't spread. But also, you know, bank runs happen really fast these days. You don't need to go to a bank to pull your deposits. You just open the app on your phone and transfer them. So I think the speed at which deposits fled was really surprising. We haven't had a bank run in this age, really. And so I think, you know, the Fed was a bit too late on that. So they did the right thing. It just was too late to save Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank, but hopefully we'll save a whole bunch of other smaller banks.
You know, Megan, the things about doing the right thing is that now the expectation, I mean, in this part of the world where the deposit guarantee is very much on the countryside, you know, we still haven't completed banking union, and that's the bit that we can't agree on. This is the bit that is going to make or break things, right? And you know, the expectation now is that given it's applied in other jurisdictions, it will apply here too. I mean, the first thing that will happen is, okay, so, you know, all deposits are guarantees. Forget about 100,000, which is 100,000 euro in the EU, $250,000 in the US. This is the first thing that is going to be discussed. And of course, you know, good luck with finding what already is a very difficult thing to agree on in the context of the banking union. You know, my worry about all this, and perhaps I will say that before we close, is that, you know, there isn't really a national market anymore. It's just national interests. So you do what you need to do to solve it. As you said, it was imperative that they solved the problem domestically. But now the expectation has ramifications that go beyond its borders. And then on top of it, you have yet another glitch in Switzerland, which again creates expectations of bondholders of that type. And then, you know, what do we have rules about? I mean, you know, we have the rules, but we also know we're going to break them if we need to break them to solve the domestic problems, forgetting that the ramifications go beyond national borders. So this is the issue that makes me think that there is something about the system that perhaps we need to rethink a little bit. And, you know, there's conversations that are going in directions of CBDCs guaranteeing deposits. All of these are interesting conversations to have, perhaps in our next podcast. But I think we need to stop now. This is all we have time for today. Thank you both for joining us. It's really fascinating discussion. It's always great to have you both to see the two sides of the Atlantic when it comes to this monetary and financial stability issues. Yeria, thank you again for joining us this time. And thank you to you, our listeners, for staying with us. And you can find all our writings, including Gregory's very interesting paper on QT, on our website, www.bruegel.org. That's all we have time today. Thank you, and see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.